Boston Research Symposium on the Late Effects of Poliomyelitis. Tape number 8, continuation, session 4.
Measurements made in the biceps muscle, the outlined areas in each of these figures is the normal limits, and the results of measurements made in 25 patients with motor neuron disease, most of whom had ALS, show the points of measurement here, which lie outside the normal values. Here we're measuring the amplitude of the spikes, and in this particular slide here, we're measuring a component of the signal which we refer to as small turns, which has to do with high frequency components. Measurements made in a patient with remote polio who had no clinical evidence of progression at the time we saw her demonstrate a pattern equivalent to that seen in patients with other types of neurogenic disease. This sort of analysis, therefore, does not provide any distinction between those two conditions. The next technique that I'll be mentioning briefly is that of single-fiber EMG. This slide merely demonstrates the portions of a motor unit that are recorded by different types of electrodes. Here on the right, the dark portion of each electrode represents the recording surface, and the conventional concentric needle electrode here in the middle is between the recording surfaces of the single fiber electrode here and the macro EMG electrode, which we'll be talking about a little bit later. The single fiber electrode records signals from muscle fibers that are quite close to the side-ported recording surface, and allows us to quantitate the number of muscle fibers that are innervated by a single anterior horn cell within a defined volume of muscle tissue around the electrode. This allows us to quantitate the same thing physiologically that muscle biopsy quantitates by type grouping, measurement of what's called fiber density. Also with single fiber electromyography, one can assess neuromuscular transmission by measuring what's referred to as the neuromuscular jitter. This slide demonstrates a sequence of changes in a muscle that has undergone partial denervation and subsequent reinnervation, presumably by regrowth of axons. We've measured, this is a recordings made in the frontalis muscle of a patient who underwent a stretch injury of the facial nerve during surgery. We've measured the fiber density and the jitter, and demonstrate that as early as 2 weeks after injury, there is an increase. Both of these values are referred to a normalized axis here, 100% being the median or mean value of normal control data from this muscle, demonstrating that as early as 2 weeks after insult, there is increase in the jitter, though the fiber density has not yet increased. Both of these two parameters increase quite markedly over the next few weeks, and then, at least in this particular condition, as the motor unit is remodeled, both fall back toward normal values after about 3 months. This is merely to demonstrate how one can use measurements with this technique in seriatim to infer changes that are taking place in motor units. The next technique is that of macro EMG, which uses the cannula of a single fiber electrode as the recording surface, and thus permits recording of the signals from all of the muscle fibers within a given motor unit, extracted from the activity ongoing in the muscle from other motor units. One derives by electronic averaging signals such as this, which by computer simulations we can infer represents the true size of a motor unit. This slide, and I'm afraid it is a bit dim, I don't know if we can turn the lights down a little bit, show the sort of information that we can obtain in patients with ALS by making measurements of fiber density and macro EMG motor units in a single muscle over time as the strength in the muscle changes. First, these again were studies made in the biceps muscle. The initial studies were made before this muscle had demonstrated any clinical weakness, and at that time showed an increased fiber density and an increased size in the macro EMG motor unit amplitude, both of which measurements increased with time, quite markedly in the case of the macro EMG size, as the strength in the muscle began to fail. And at the end of the time in which we followed this, the size of the macro EMG motor unit potential fell quite dramatically, a sequence of events which has been interpreted in this slide from Eric Stahlberg as probably representing deterioration of the motor unit, dropout of individual constituents of the motor unit, either single muscle fibers or branches of the terminal axon, which no longer are contributing to the electrical signals that we are recording. And I think one can see how application of these techniques to patients who had had polio in the past could also help to distinguish among different types of physiologic changes that might be taking place. There are three major questions that I think we can address in the post-polio muscular atrophy syndrome using EMG techniques. The first is one that has been addressed by other studies previously and addressed quite well by the presentations yesterday. Do the EMG findings in this syndrome differ from those of other anterior horn cell diseases? And to make a story short, the answer is no. None of the techniques that we have applied, admittedly to as yet a small number of patients, less than two dozen, with polio, some of whom have progression, none of these studies have demonstrated a pattern of individual findings that differs in a way that allows us to distinguish these patients from patients with classical amyotrophic lateral sclerosis. All have fasciculations to some degree in some muscles, fibrillations, positive sharp waves, neurogenic motor unit potentials and interference pattern, increased fiber density and jitter on single fiber EMG, increased size of macro EMG motor units, and increased number of motor units estimated from macro EMG studies. This is just a slide that summarizes some of our preliminary work comparing quantitative measurements of various sorts in patients with motor neuron disease and those with old polio. The small symbols here represent patients with classical ALS. The large open circles represent patients with remote polio. And I think you can see that the measurements of fiber density, I think that's macro EMG amplitude and the routine concentric needle EMG amplitude, none of these show any patterns that differ among these two conditions. The outline areas in each of these figures represents the normal range of values from control studies. One feature of the single fiber EMG that has been mentioned in the context of post-polio muscular atrophy syndrome is that of neurogenic blocking, phenomenon originally described by Stahlberg and Teeley, I believe, in 1972. This slide is from their paper. It's a phenomenon that's recognized on single fiber EMG when one has a very complex recording, later components of which, at least two later components of which, jitter together. That is, they move in time with reference to a marking signal at the beginning of the motor unit potential and intermittently fail to fire concomitantly. This has been interpreted as indicating an intermittent failure of conduction in the terminal branch, or at least the axon before the terminal branch that goes to two or more muscle fibers. The presence of neurogenic blocking indicates an abnormality in the peripheral nerve, and its absence in patients with progressive post-polio muscular atrophy syndrome in some studies has been inferred as evidence against there being an abnormality in the axon. However, I think one must obviously be cautious in interpreting the absence of findings unless one has control observations in the same laboratory in other diseases in which neurogenic blocking is expected to occur. The second question that one can address electromyographically is, are the involved muscles those that were most severely involved initially, that is, the muscles with progressive weakness? And there are a number of measurements that one can make in a large number of muscles and compare in order to determine the severity of involvement of those muscles and compare this with the symptoms and with the evidence on manual muscle testing or other measures of strength testing that weakness is progressing in these muscles. I've starred here fiber density measurements because I think of all the techniques that can be applied to a given muscle, the one that is probably most likely to give the useful information in as efficient a way as possible is fiber density measurements. The final question is there further loss of motor units or peripheral fractionation of the motor unit in progressive post-polio muscular atrophy syndrome? And this, of course, presupposes that there is such a syndrome. This question cannot be answered by studies performed at one point in time. But these techniques, performed serially in a single muscle over a period of time, correlated with measurements of strength in that muscle, would be the approach most likely to answer these questions. How one would distinguish between loss of motor units and peripheral fractionation involves a consideration of changes in fiber density and macro EMG motor unit size with respect to measurements of the surface recorded compound muscle action potential. But there are changes such as we saw in the serial studies on the patient with ALS, I think, that would allow us to make those inferences and to distinguish between these two possibilities if, in fact, these two processes were going on in isolation. Thank you.
All set for questions? Don will remain up here and answer them. Hopefully.
Jasper Dobby, Don, that was an excellent review of the applications to electrophysiology to the problem that we're all addressing. And in particular, I was interested in your macro EMG methods, one that, as I mentioned, we have not used in these patients. And you nicely showed that in ALS, near the end of the course, there is a reduction in size of the macro EMG. Recordings. If in fact what's happening in the post-polio patients is a loss of fibers from an anterior horn cell that can't maintain them all, we should see the same reduction in size in the macro EMG recording. And my question is, have you made any comparisons of macro EMG in muscles that are progressing with those in muscles that are not progressing equally severely involved in individual patients?
You mean who've had polio or with ALS? This is a study that's currently in progress, and as you are undoubtedly aware, it requires observations made in a number of patients before you can get data that you're willing to base anything on. But we're in the process of doing that now, and that is obviously one of the major questions that we want to answer.
I would comment on that. I've been looking at that since about 1983, and it becomes very difficult from the standpoint that you can find almost any motor unit size that you want in these polio muscles. And so when you go back for the second and the third shot on these patients, you have no way of knowing which motor units, which 20 you first selected on your first study, and whether or not the 20 that you looked at the second time were in any way, shape, or form related to the first 20. So what I've tried to do is to find muscles where I could only find 20 different motor units. And surprisingly, some of these muscles are of anti-gravity strength where there's only 20 motor units or less. But again, it's very difficult because you really don't know that you're getting into the same motor units. And there's such a tremendous variability in motor unit size that I don't know that the technique will allow it. It may just be too much and only time will tell.
None of these techniques is...
This was Dr. Weekers making this comment.
None of these techniques is capable of giving us all the information in isolation, and we would compare the results, for example, from the macro EMG studies with the surface recorded compound muscle action potential to get an idea of the relationship between overall progression and loss of muscle fibers and changes in individual motor unit size in order to come to some of these conclusions.
Peter Gow, as a non-neurophysiologist, can you tell me whether you get any EMG changes according to the functional metabolic state? For example, if there's changes in nutrition or before or after exercise, can you get changes in EMG, or is it purely structural?
That's a very difficult question to answer. One shouldn't see changes, significant changes in the electrical activity that we're recording under most conditions of normal metabolism. One thing that has to be borne in mind, however, is that all of these measurements are based on a sampling of a population of motor units. And it's not impossible that under conditions of fatigue or other metabolic stress, one might change the population of motor units that was active under a given circumstance. And that would show up in our studies, perhaps as a change in the size of motor unit action potentials. And that's something that we have not really looked into in great detail, but it's something that we'd have to bear in mind.
Don, I also enjoy your review. I have one question about the fiber density. Did you see any differences between post-polio and ALS in the degree of fiber density from the histological point of view, histochemistry, I mean with the muscle, with enzyme histochemistry? There is the grouping in post-polio appears to be bigger, much larger than the ALS, and I was wondering if with the fiber density you have found the same thing.
In looking at the fiber density, again, we have to bear in mind that we're sampling, and we use certain measures of central tendency to give us an overall number for fiber density, but equally important is the distribution of the number of muscle fibers throughout a muscle. As yet, we don't have enough patient data to make a comparison that would allow us to say whether the significant difference in either of these two factors between patients who've had polio and patients who have ALS. A confounding variable is, of course, that ALS is not a static process, and if we measure the fiber density in the muscle, biceps, one biceps or any muscle of a patient with ALS, compare it with the other side, we're going to get differences depending upon the severity of involvement of the two muscles. That's one of the characteristics of ALS. If you look at them, especially early on in the disease, that there are significant differences in the distribution of abnormality among different muscles depending upon the stage of the disease. To make a long question short, we really don't have the numbers yet to answer that.
Alan Berger, Albert Einstein, New York. Just a comment on the distribution of changes. We've found that although the patients are very accurately able to identify which muscles are apparently getting weak, we found that in many of these patients, the electrophysiologic changes of motor unit disintegration, mainly single fiber jitter blocking and some spontaneous activity, far exceeded the limitations of their muscles, so that they may complain only of one limb being involved, but the homologous muscles on the other side, which had no complaints at all, were also showing evidence of motor unit disintegration.
I think that's one thing that's come out of this, and studies that others have performed, especially those that Jasper mentioned yesterday. We can see all these things in any muscle, but it doesn't seem to be restricted to the muscles in which there's clinical evidence of change. And that's the... I'd just like to make one point about some of the comments that were made yesterday. It's absolutely essential that one do the sort of blind studies necessary to distinguish changes that are of relevance to the clinical change, the clinical progression, and changes that are residua of the original disease. Without that sort of observation, we don't really know cause and effect. Our approach is to do serial studies in muscles that we define as being potentially progressively weak, comparing them with the opposite side in order to see whether there are differences in these two possibly controlled situations.
Thank you, Don. Our next speaker is, I'm always embarrassed by saying needs no introduction because then they go on to give one, but Dr. McComas is from Hamilton and McMaster.
Can I ask, Ernie, how long do I actually have? How many minutes? 10 minutes, right.
I may give you 11.
Right, okay. Right. Off we go then. I'm a neuroscientist, but I don't work at the Mayo Clinic, and therefore rather than peering down at you from a lofty pinnacle, I'm looking up at you from a lowly foothill. Now, in the course of his excellent presentation yesterday, Dr. Jasper Dalby made reference to motor unit counting, and suggested that this would be a useful technique for examining patients with the post-polio syndrome. I'm not going to talk at all about the development of this technique, although Walter Bradley, who was with me in Newcastle at the time, may recall the cries of frustration that issued from the room next to his while we were working on it. What I would like to do, however, is to quickly run over the methodology, describe the applications of the technique to motor neurone disorders, and then, if time permits, introduce you to two other relatively novel electrophysiological techniques which might be applicable to the post-polio syndrome. So if we start off with motor unit counting, the idea is very simple. One simply compares the mean size of a motor unit potential with that of the whole muscle. And on this slide, you see superimposed cathode ray oscilloscope traces. One gradually increases the strength of the stimulus from a sub-threshold value and records the responses of the muscle on the cathode ray oscilloscope screen. And you can see that as the stimulus to the muscle is increased, the response grows in steps like this. And each of these increments is interpreted, rightly or wrongly, as being the excitation of an additional motor unit. Now, immediately you can see that in this patient with a post-polio syndrome, the sizes of the increments are very much larger than those in a control subject studied in the same way using the same amplification. And our interpretation of that would be that in the patient, the sizes of the motor units have been enlarged by collateral reinnervation. Obviously, muscle fiber hypertrophy could be a further factor. When the strength of the stimulus is increased and the maximum responses are recorded, you can see that the response in the patient is very much smaller than that in the control subject. And this means that the numbers of excitable muscle fibers is smaller in the patient than in the control. Now, when we take the mean sizes of these increments and divide them into the maximum response, we estimate that in the patient there are about 17 motor units in this extensor digitorum brevis muscle, whereas in the control subject, studied in exactly the same way, there are about 128. Now, these are very approximate figures because there are all sorts of assumptions in the method. There are methodological difficulties, which I don't propose to go into. And even when the same observer is studying the same subject on repeated occasions, there is a coefficient of variation, which you remember is the standard deviation divided by the mean as a percentage. A coefficient of variation which ranges from 8 to 16% depending on the muscle that you're looking at. As Jasper Dolby said yesterday, the technique does work much better for patients who have losses of motor units. Now, what I'd like to do is just quickly show you the muscles that have been looked at from the point of view of this technique. There are certain easy ones, those which we also use. Others that collaborators have investigated, and then larger muscles which we've attempted to work with and are just frankly unsuitable. The next slide shows the arrangements of the stimulating and recording electrodes of those four muscles or muscle groups which we have found most useful. Let me say that both the stimulating electrodes and the recording electrodes are surface, and that the technique takes no more than 3 minutes per muscle. I have myself done more than 20,000 muscles. My technician does the technique much better than I do now, and it only takes her a few minutes. The next slide shows the control values for four muscles here. As you see, there are quite a large number of subjects that have been studied now. And what I'd like to do now is to go on and show you the application of the technique to patients with ALS. We're looking at two muscles now, the thenar group supplied by the median nerve and the extensor digitorum brevis. The number of motor units is shown along the abscissa in each case, and the interrupted vertical line shows you the lower limit of the respective control range. The columns that are open are those for subjects above the age of 60, and the filled ones are those below the age of 60. And of the 236 muscles studied, the motor unit count at the time of diagnosis was reduced in 224, so that's an abnormality in 95% of cases. Now, as Dr. Dalby also said yesterday, what is particularly meaningful is to study these patients again. And the next slide shows you such results. This is all for ALS. Notice that the abscissa is in months. And you can see even at the time of first diagnosis that some muscles have very few motor units remaining. And little change takes place over the next few months. Sometimes you find a muscle which has a normal complement of motor units when the patient is first seen, but in this case, for example, you can see that within 6 months the number of units is reduced to half. So the rate of denervation can be alarmingly high in ALS. Now this stands in sharp contrast to patients with spinal muscular atrophy. Notice now that we're dealing not in months but in years, and some of our patients have now been studied over a 10-year or longer span. And allowing for the experimental error of the technique, you can see that really in most muscles there's no significant change. In one subject there was actually an increase in the motor unit count which exceeded the methodological error, and I think that this actually demonstrates that there are in some patients a population of sick motor neurons that may temporarily improve, and indeed this patient had improved considerably. Now the technique also tells you, as I said earlier, about the sizes of the motor units and therefore the amount of collateral reinnervation. And here you see a plot of the number of functioning motor units in patients with ALS against the mean sizes of the motor unit potentials. And the relationship is approximately a rectangular hyperbola, such that the fewer motor units remaining, the larger the sizes of those motor units, and some of them are very large indeed. Now, what about the other two techniques I hinted at? Well, both of these have to do with measurements of muscle contraction, not voluntary contraction, but stimulated contraction. And the muscles that we prefer to use are the dorsiflexors and plantar flexors of the ankle. Dorsiflexors of the ankle are muscles that Leonard Grimby and his group also use, so I sense that his ears are pricking up. Now, this is the apparatus that we use. The foot is strapped to a plate under which there are strain gauges, and we can adjust the position of the ankle to any degree that we like. The appropriate nerve, either common peroneal nerve or tibial nerve, is stimulated with surface electrodes at the ankle. And not only do we measure the torque developed by the muscle, but also the compound action potential as well. And the first technique is that of the interpolated twitch. Now, what this attempts to do is to find out whether a subject is contracting, is employing rather, all their motor units, and if they are, whether the motor units are firing at an optimum frequency for the development of force. It's not our own idea. The idea was reported by Pat Merton, a Cambridge physiologist, in 1954 in a classical paper, but it lay dormant for 30 years, and we resurrected it a few years ago. What you get the subject to do is to make a maximum voluntary contraction. And in the course of that contraction, you give a single maximal stimulus to the nerve, and you look to see if there is any superimposed twitch on the force recording. And obviously, if the patient is already contracting all his motor units at an optimal frequency, then the stimulus will not give any extra twitch, but just a momentary loss of force due to collision of impulses. On the other hand, if the subject is not contracting fully, then the stimulus gives a twitch, which you can see on the force recording. And the next slide shows the results in the McMaster University squash champion. Here are the results for the dorsiflexors of the ankle. Here, the plantar flexors of the ankle. Here, the dorsiflexors. And if you just look at the lower part of the figure, here's the subject resting, here's his control twitch, and as he deliberately makes stronger and stronger contractions, so the interpolated twitch gets smaller and smaller. And in his case, as in about half of the population, you cannot quite activate all the motor units in the plantar flexor muscles. In contrast, in the dorsiflexor muscles, you can see that the twitch completely disappears. You can't see it even at high amplification recordings. And this is true for the adductor of the thumb, the quadriceps femoris, and also the diaphragm. That is the work of others. Now, the last technique is that of repetitive stimulation. Repetitive stimulation is used a great deal, obviously, in the diagnosis of myasthenia gravis, but there has been a tendency to use relatively low rates of stimulation and only for a few seconds. What we have been doing is to blast away at the muscle using any frequencies of stimulation up to 100 hertz for times as long as 3 minutes, with the muscle ischemic until we have abolished all the contractile response of the muscle. And, well, this simply shows you the experimental setup. It's similar to the one which I've just described. This is a set of recordings made in a 52-year-old subject whose identity I will not further disclose. And you can see on the top trace that when he was stimulated at 20 hertz, the tetanic torque gradually subsided and completely disappeared, and the compound action potential after a small increment declined but did not completely disappear. And these are simply compound action potential measurements made at intervals in the course of the 3 minutes. Now, instead of doing continuous stimulation, you can do intermittent stimulation. And in this experiment here, we gave 3-second stimuli at 30 hertz every 5 seconds. This is the control tetanus preceded by a twitch, and you can see that as the experiment goes on, you get potentiation of the twitch, and then the twitch disappears. The tetanic tension gets smaller, the rate of rise of tension gets slower, and eventually both the twitch and the tetanic tension have completely disappeared, and then when the stimulation is stopped and the cuff released, you can see the tension come back again. All right. So three techniques then. Now, in summary, what is their application to the post-polio syndrome? Well, motor unit counting is obviously useful. I think in that it will tell one whether or not whole motor units are being lost, and therefore whether or not motor neurons are dying or at least becoming dysfunctional in the spinal cord. And of particular relevance is the concept that there may be premature aging of motor neurons in the post-polio syndrome. This is my last slide, and it shows in a normal population how numbers of motor units decline with age. And by and large, there really isn't very much change until the age of 60, and then after that, there is a progressive loss. And those of you who were at the previous meeting 2 years ago will remember that Bernard Tomlinson showed very similar results based on anatomical counts of motor neurons in the lumbosacral cord. So far as the interpolated twitch is concerned, I think this might be useful for two reasons. As we heard yesterday, some patients do have an upper motor neuron component to their weakness. Furthermore, in those who are moderately disabled, there is a disuse phenomenon such that patients seem no longer able to fully activate their motor neurons. This is seen even in normal subjects after a limb has been in a plaster cast for a few weeks. Alain Belanger and I showed it in patients with limb girdle muscular dystrophy and myotonic dystrophy. It seems as if the central nervous system has forgotten how to drive the motor neurons fully. So far as tetanic stimulation is concerned, if Marino Stelakis is correct about nerve terminal failure in the post-polio syndrome, there should be an unusually early decrement in the muscle compound action potential as one stimulates repetitively. Furthermore, it's also possible that some of the weakness in the post-polio syndrome is due to the so-called secondary myopathic changes, which can complicate any chronic denervating disorder. And in such disorders, there may well be defects in excitation-contraction coupling or in the contractile process itself. And those would also be expected to show up in tetanic stimulation. In closing, I would like to add my thanks to those of the other participants, to Dr. Lara Halstead, and the others who have organized this meeting and made it such an enjoyable one. Thank you.
All set for questions now for Dr. McComas.
Antel Montreal, if I could ask a question related to ALS, Ted Munsett has presented very nice data over the last while about the progressive linear deterioration in the disease. Do your techniques, counting motor units, confirm that observation, or are there is there stuttering along the course of motor neuron disease? I couldn't really tell from the slide that you presented.
Well, all sorts of things can happen, actually. I would say that the most common pattern is for there to be a fairly rapid loss in the number of functioning motor units, and then after that there's either stabilization or a slow deterioration. Now, there are exceptions to that. For example, we have one patient whom I've studied over a period of 5 years now, in whom the number of motor units has actually increased on occasions, and not just in one muscle, but in the several that we've studied. And this has coincided with her symptomatology, inasmuch that she has felt better on those occasions and able to do more. And these have been very dramatic changes. I mean, they're far outside the error of the method.
Munsett, Boston. Actually, the changes in maximum voluntary contraction in ALS patients with time corresponds, Alan, I think, to what you're saying in your motor unit count. When you first start testing the patient, when that muscle is normal or almost normal, it's rather stable, and then they enter a phase of rapid decline. There's a decline phase, and during that phase, the fall off is reasonably linear. Linearity is a matter of degree. It's quite linear for a biological phenomena. But then they bottom out sometimes at a modest amount of muscle force remaining, and may stay that way actually for many years. It's as though they have two or three or maybe four motor units in that muscle that will persist almost indefinitely.
Alan Berger, New York. Most of the work that's being done seems to center on either the activity of whole muscles or muscle groups or the activity of the motor unit as a whole. And there's another technique that has been being used more frequently now that can look at the activity of single muscle fibers, the firing patterns of single muscle fibers that may get to some of the functional deficit both in the activation of the motor unit and in its individual properties.
Not sure what you mean by that. I mean, is this something other than the single fiber recording technique that we've heard about?
Yes, you can take you could isolate the single muscle fiber single muscle fiber potential and get the firing characteristic when joint interval histograms, etc. It's been used in spastic patients and normal Parkinson patients.
Yes.
And show differences in the joint interval histogram, how they're firing the individual muscle fibers.
Well, perhaps Dr. Leonard Grimby, who's in the audience, might like to say something about that, because I know this is one of his specialties. Leonard? Have I caught you by surprise?
You mean the differences between normal subjects and PPMA subjects or ALS subjects? What do you refer? I didn't touch it. It is of course possible to look at single motor unit and get the same, about the same, draw about the same conclusions as the McComas did now. You can see the firing rates, if there is or should be a central component, if there are blockings of the peripheral electrical propagation and such things, and I don't think that The problem in diseases is a statistical problem, and go further down to the single motor units, then the statistical problems increase very much. So that I think, and it's very easy to make very detailed analysis on single motor unit level, but then it is more difficult to draw conclusions from it.
We're all set for our next speaker. As was announced yesterday, Dr. Shahani was unavoidably absent from our program, and Dr. Christian Borg from the Karolinska Institute has a message to give us. Dr. Borg.
Not working. Mr. Chairman, ladies and gentlemen, it has been shown in animal experiments that long-term electrical tetanization can cause a transition of type 2 to type 1 muscle fibers. It has been claimed that the muscle fiber types are determined by their long-term use. The aim of this study was to analyze the use of remaining low and high threshold motor units in the anterior tibial muscle during walking in antecedent polio, and to elucidate the consequences of overuse for the muscle fiber differentiation. The study was performed during walking, as this is the main function of the muscle. The single unit EMG was recorded by a wire or a thin needle electrode, which was inserted into a cluster of muscle fibers innervated by one and the same motor neuron. A global EMG was recorded with surface electrodes. The degree of use of the remaining motor units was defined as the quotient between the EMG during walking and the EMG during maximal voluntary contraction, and was expressed in percentage of the normal use. This slide shows single unit recordings from the anterior tibial muscle during walking. The two upper recordings are from a normal subject, and A1 here shows the lowest threshold motor neurons firing at rates of about 10 hertz, and A2 the highest threshold motor neurons which do not participate in each step cycle. B, this one here, is a recording from a polio patient who uses all remaining motor units in each step cycle. And it's with firing rates between 25 to 50 hertz, and that's about the same rates as during maximal voluntary contraction. The next slide shows muscle biopsies taken by a percutaneous concutome method and stained by myosin ATPase after acid pre-incubation in pH 4.3. And the upper one shows a biopsy from a polio patient with ordinary use of the muscle. And this muscle has a normal fiber differentiation, while the muscle biopsy here has a lost differentiation with only type 1 fibers. And this is a polio patient who had a neurophysiologically verified overuse of the anterior tibial muscle during walking.
The next slide is a summary of the results.
Please turn tape to slide 2.